This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And of course, on the air, Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the big post-election show. I'm doing the air quotes. Post-election show.
Tonight, more than 200 years after a former colony won the right to determine its own destiny, the task of perfecting our union moves forward. It moves forward because of you. It moves forward because you reaffirmed the spirit that has triumphed over war and depression, the spirit that has lifted this country from the depths of despair to the great heights of hope, the belief that while each of us will pursue our own individual dreams, we are an American family and we rise or fall together as one nation and as one people.
We're going to dive into a roundtable discussion hosted by healthcare analyst Christopher Flavelle, joined by Lauren Duggan, congressional analyst, and Katie North, a financial analyst with BGov, all of whom are discussing what the president should look forward to over the next 6 weeks. I also had an opportunity to speak with former Senator Tom Daschle about the election, about fiscal cliff, about affordable care, and more. Stay with us. It's a show chock full of stuff, kicking it off with Chris Flavelle.
I'm joined by a number of fantastic BGov analysts. Let's start with you, Rich. Give us an idea of what this means for the fiscal cliff and what some scenarios are for coming together on taxes. Is it possible to find a deal that both sides will agree to?
Boy, it's going to be really hard. So the way I've been thinking about this is that the president, after getting reelected with what they'll claim is a mandate on taxes, faces really the biggest test on tax policy before his second term even starts. So you've got all these tax cuts that are expiring at the end of the year. The president says the tax rates on higher income people should go up. The Republicans say extend the rates the way they are. House Republicans are back in their majority. Senate Democrats are back in their majority. Obama's back. So you've got the same people who haven't been able to resolve this issue before the election coming back now trying to resolve it after the election.
But is there a mandate from the election? Do you think that Obama has a stronger hand and can claim some sort of popular support for his approach to the problem? Or are they just where they are in terms of the numbers?
Yes and yes. I mean, Obama will absolutely claim that level of support. He'll say, look, I campaigned on higher taxes for high-income people. Let's do that. He also campaigned on that in 2008, and it didn't happen then either. But the numbers matter because House Republicans are still there and they still have a majority and they still don't want to raise taxes. And so who blinks is basically the real issue. Are Republicans really willing to go over the fiscal cliff and let everything expire? Is the president really willing to go over the fiscal cliff and let everything expire? My sort of roadmap for the next 6 weeks is expect 1 to 2 to 3 weeks of posturing, 1 to 2 to 3 weeks of negotiating, and then either a deal or not.
Lauren, you know Congress as well as any of us. Is this posturing, do you think Republicans are willing to give on this position of no tax increases, or do they really believe this?
I think it'll be hard for the House Republicans to change their position on this, at least initially. And as Rich points out, there could be this posturing for a few weeks where they could point to the vote they already took to extend the tax cuts for all income levels as their position going into negotiations. The Senate Democrats have their position too, which has been this $250,000 level. Maybe there's a bargaining room in between those two levels where a deal could be cut, but we were in this position 2 years ago in 2010 when the Bush-era tax cuts were about to expire, and we wound up with a deal that gave us 2 years of an extension for everyone. So I think the dynamics are hard to figure out. Rich may be more optimistic than me that they can reach a deal by the end of the year. And there's already talk from Jim Clyburn on the Democratic side and John Boehner on the House side of maybe a bridge or a patch or something to get us over there. That might not be acceptable to some people either because of using the end of the year deadline as kind of a bargaining tool in itself.
If we go over the fiscal cliff, which party takes more of the blame?
Well, I think that's what the next few weeks are about, is each side trying to assign blame for what might happen to the other side. And so there'll be a lot, that's what the posturing is trying to make sure that the other party looks intransigent. So you'll see the president saying, look, everybody agrees, I got reelected, you know, it's just the House Republicans, and the House Republicans, you know, if you talk to them and say, look, the economy's not and is appreciably better than it was 2 years ago when Obama signed an extension, he'll do it again. And they also say, look at, because it's Washington, we always look to the next election, they say, look at the list of senators up in 2014. You've got a number of senators elected from states that supported Governor Romney last night. And the Republican bet is that those senators will start looking ahead and being nervous about voting for tax increases.
Katie, obviously, imposing all of this, we have a very aggressive regulatory agenda. Dodd-Frank in particular, what does last night mean for Dodd-Frank? Is there a mandate, do you think, to continue through with it? Will the president want to compromise on some of those rules that are most controversial? What do you see happening next?
So over 2 years after Dodd-Frank, we're barely halfway finished implementing it. So there's a long way to go. And I think where you'll see is that, for the most part, it will be status quo regulation. We'll continue going through with all of the new SEC regulations, CFTC, everything from derivatives to investor protections. And then most importantly, some very strong prudential regulations for the largest systemically important banks. We'll see all that continue down the line. Where we might see some flashpoints, if you will, is with regard to the CFPB. Richard Cordray needs to be confirmed by the full Senate. Obviously, you need 60 votes to make that happen. And I see a scenario potentially where the senators could come together and agree with some sort of package with the House on maybe making some tweaks and changes to the oversight of the CFPB to help increase sort of congressional review process and maybe even look at a commission structure for that agency as well. Obviously, they're working on a lot of major issues related to mortgages, credit card reforms, and even student loan issues. And of course, with Elizabeth Warren winning her position there in Massachusetts, she's going to jockey to try and become a member of the Senate Banking Committee. And obviously, these things will remain in play. Whether or not any major changes can happen on Dodd-Frank, I think it's not likely, just because of the makeup of the Senate. But she's going to be a very strong proponent of keeping Dodd-Frank in place.
Lauren, let me go back to you. Do you see anything from last night that would suggest reduced opposition from House Republicans to the president's major legislative agenda items, the ACA, Dodd-Frank? Do you think part of that, they'll say, you know what, we tried to fight this tooth and nail, didn't really work, now we're willing to work a little more with the administration on shaping these laws, or is it the same sort of, we will fight, full stop?
I think it's hard because the result of the election was essentially a continuation of the status quo. President Obama can say, I ran on this, this is what I did, I was reelected, so therefore I'm vindicated. House Republicans could say the same thing. They may loosen their position a little bit and maybe not do a full-out repeal vote again. They've done that twice in the last 2 years to try and repeal the Affordable Care Act, and they've not been successful getting that through the Senate. I see nothing to change that dynamic. But, you know, there's individual policy provisions that they could look at, talk about funding for the different agencies that have to implement this, maybe try and reshape the regulations that are going through. I think the appropriations process could be a place where both Dodd-Frank and the healthcare law are possibly going to come up a lot, because these agencies will need funding in the context of deficit reduction, which is still the big thing looming over every policy decision, is how do you save money in governing? These agencies could be looked at as a source or a way to do that.
Rich, obviously a lot of money going to the healthcare law. Do you see any role in perhaps rolling back parts of that law as part of a deal over the deficit?
It's hard. I mean, you know, the president, you know, campaigned on the healthcare law. He talked about it a lot on the campaign trail, claimed it as a success. And so anything, obviously he'd veto any repeal or any significant overhaul to the law, but even any little chips at it are require giving political capital for him. So that doesn't mean he won't do it, but it almost makes it harder for him to give those things away because he did it, he campaigned on it, and he won on it. And so he very much sees that as part of his legacy, and that makes it much harder to give away.
One of the points that I think Bloomberg viewers will be especially familiar with is this argument that I think is true, that just by raising taxes on the wealthy, you can't begin to solve the deficit problem. Are there other measures that you think are going to be, if not easy to agree on, then at least a good first step in terms of closing the deficit, maybe certain tax expenditures or other tax increases that you think probably will be part of a deal?
I don't think so. I think this has to happen all together. This is deficit reduction, unless it really happens in a very piecemeal kind of way. Deficit reduction with divided government means everybody holding hands and jumping in together. And so to get anything at the 2 to 4 to 5 trillion level over 10 years, that's going to mean tax overhaul. It's going to mean entitlement reform. It's going to mean probably more changes on discretionary spending. And so the parties can't agree on that unless they all do it at the same time. So that's really the barrier. And the way I've been thinking about that is, look, it's sort of inevitable that they'll do something that is bipartisan and achieves deficit reduction. It's also, if you look at it, impossible at the same time. And so how they reconcile that is really the big question for both the next 6 weeks and then for the 113th Congress.
Katie, I want to go back to Dodd-Frank for a moment. The exit polls I saw said that something like 60% of voters chose the economy as the most important issue when voting. Do you feel like there are any changes that the president might want to make now that he has perhaps more leeway, isn't worried about another re-election campaign, that would shift his focus on financial regulations, say?
You know, I think that the law really has been written and he wants to stick with it as sort of it was written. There is some wiggle room that you will see happening at the regulators, and of course by the end of the year perhaps we could have a new Treasury Secretary and even a new SEC Chairman. And so obviously the roles that those folks play as regulators, there's major regulators trying to implement this now, they do have some leeway in terms of how these regulations ultimately affect the industry and then as an extension of that, the economy. So what we may see is, even though we won't see a legislative path for much change in Dodd-Frank, we may see some incremental changes at the regulatory level. And then in addition, perhaps some additional court challenges might stop or slow down the implementation of Dodd-Frank rules as well. That's a very real concern.
If the Senate really won't confirm Richard Cordray, is there some other compromise candidate you can see that would be an easier shot there?
At this point, none has really risen to that. We haven't seen anything. I think what will happen is they will pursue a path to try to get agreement. And if that doesn't work, may have to go to some other choice.
The healthcare law, of course, has a similar problem, which is this board called the IPAB. They need to have a chairman appointed by the Senate, confirmed by the Senate, soon. Do you guys see any sense that Republicans will budge on their opposition to that central component of the healthcare law?
Well, here's one thing to watch. So right now, as we sit here now, the Democrats have 53 seats in the Senate. They can could get, they're leading in Montana and North Dakota, and get to 55. So, which is higher than the 53, including independents, they have now. So in some ways, you can see on certain issues, Majority Leader Reid going back to the model he used in 07 and 08 when they had a similar size majority, which is, let me go find 3 to 5 to 7 Republicans who I can negotiate with and get a deal to get to 60 votes to overcome the filibuster. That was a lot harder when they were at 53 and you were heading into a presidential cycle when the Republicans thought they could take back the Senate. Republicans do think that again this time, but you've got at least that possibility on issues where he can work with Susan Collins of Maine, with Dean Heller reelected in Nevada, you know, with the more moderate Republican senators, there's some opening. I'm not sure if IPAB is that issue, but I would look for that on some issues as a governing coalition.
I wanted to close by asking each of you what you're watching for next. For healthcare, certainly the issue is the regulations. They've been on hold for a few months. We're expecting a mini flood of regulations. What do you look for, starting with you and Dodd-Frank, what's the next thing to be alert to?
The first thing I see is a turnover in some of the regulatory agencies, like I mentioned, but other than that, there are three major issues that I see happening potentially before the end of the year. One is the implementation of this package of prudential regulations, heightened standards for systemically important banks. Two is the Volcker Rule, getting a final opinion on what that actually means for banks and how they're going to be implementing it through 2014. And then finally, we're going to have some designations of non-bank firms like insurance companies, maybe some broker-dealers, that will also be designated as SIFIs and have to comply with these new heightened standards as well.
How about Rich? What's on your radar?
I think we're expecting the president, or a lot of people are expecting the president, to come out with some sort of fiscal cliff plan that's more detailed than what he said before. So that could be this week, it could be next week, but that's sort of the first step, and he'll really sort of help frame the debate for the next 6 weeks going forward.
Well, I'll close with you. What are you most excited about right now? What are you watching for to happen?
I want to see how the Senate and the House get along in these next 6 weeks, because that will set the stage for the next 2 years. I think the Senate has to come to a different way of running itself, because what's happened for the last 2 years has been pretty much stalemate, and maybe there's a way forward, maybe some of the new faces coming in. Some people have said that the increase in the number of women could change the way that the Senate operates. There's at least 19, maybe 20, depending on the results in North Dakota. I think the different faces and the people who came here and want to get things done could make it run differently and maybe help some of these issues move forward.
I just spoke with Governor Romney, and I congratulated him and Paul Ryan on a hard-fought campaign. We may have battled fiercely, but it's only because we love this country deeply and we care so strongly about its future. From George to Lenore to their son Mitt, the Romney family has chosen to give back to America through public service. And that is a legacy that we honor and applaud tonight. In the weeks ahead, I also look forward to sitting down with Governor Romney to talk about where we can work together to move this country forward.
Shortly after the election, I had an opportunity to speak to former Senator Tom Daschle about the election and fiscal cliff and a whole bunch more. Unfortunately, because of some damage in master control, our interview didn't quite record the way we thought it did. So I've edited together the segments that are listenable. I hope you enjoy it. It's the post-election edition of Capital Impact, and we've pulled out all the stops, bringing in the man, the myth, the legend, former Senate Majority Leader, Mr. Tom Daschle. Mr. Daschle, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you, thank you. So before we dive into the meat of what I really want to talk to you about, I'm just kind of curious. You've been in public service for years, since like the mid-70s, being a part of an election or viewing election returns and such. The night of the election, as you're viewing the returns, just like everyone else, I'm sure, I'm curious, were you in bed? Did you have a bowl of popcorn? Did you go out? Like, tell me how it went down at the Daschle household.
Well, this is the first time we've ever done what we did last night. Last night, we decided we'd watch the returns from our home. Usually, 4 years ago, we went to Chicago. 2 years ago, we were with Senator Reid and his entourage.
President Obama is back in office 4 more years, but we have a little gray period. They call it the lame duck session between now and the end of the year, when the new senators and representatives come and take office, and possibly the president, but not in this case. What kind of things would you, if you were an advisor to the president, would you suggest he put on his plate?
Well, unfortunately, I think the plate is already predetermined, and the plate has everything to do with something we call the fiscal cliff. They've got 16 business days, 16 legislative days within which to solve a $500 billion tax increase and $110 billion expenditure cut, all at the same time, all taking effect on January 1st. So the plate is very full, the stakes are extremely high, and the circumstances couldn't be more complicated.
So the president obviously is back in office. Everybody has their own ideas on how this should be resolved. We've got the same people coming back into town to handle this post-election. Is there going to be any wiggle room? Who will be the first to bend?
I don't know that anybody can say. My hope is that everybody bends and everybody gives and everybody is as innovative and creative as they need to be to solve the problem. The stakes are so high. We're finally making some progress with economic recovery. And this could put us right back into economic oblivion if we fail to do this right. So I think the circumstances themselves require a different tack and a different attitude. But I think also, given the fact that politics will never be any less relevant than they are at this point.
Last time we had you on the program was just before the Supreme Court ruled on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Fast forward now 4 months, and the president ran on a big health care platform, elected on this platform, the public has spoken, so to speak. Do you see any potential relaxing of the opposition now?
I think there is going to be some relaxing. I don't think you're going to see the repeal efforts that we've seen for so long. There is little doubt in my mind, however, that we'll continue to see a legislative agenda.
Let's talk a little bit about Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank, lots of activity going on around this now, especially between now and the end of the year. Lots of regulations we need to discuss, lots of information that needs to be dispensed. Is the president going to bend on this at all?
I don't think there's much of an inclination on the part of the president to bend. In fact, I think, if anything, he's more resolute. He feels that he made his case in the campaign and the election. The law has been passed, and he wants to move forward with implementation.
So, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. I'm gonna let you go on this one. Your president calls you and says, you know what, Senator? I want you to come and be a part of the team. How about chief of staff? How about what would it take if the president were to make that phone call? What would it take to get you to step into the White House?
Well, the fortunate thing is he's got about 1,000 calls just like that to make before he gets to me.
Understood.
I don't really expect it, and I don't. We've got a wonderful friendship and relationship, and I think I can serve him well in the current role that I play, and I look forward to continue to do that.
Very good. Senator, on that, I will bid you adieu. Thank you very much for joining the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day.
You too.
Former Senator Tom Daschle on the president and more. I want to thank Lindsay for making that interview happen, and of course, the senator himself for being a part of the program.
This election is over, but our principles endure. I believe that the principles upon which this nation was founded are the only sure guide to a resurgent economy and to renewed greatness. Like so many of you, Paul and I have left everything on the field. We have given our all to this campaign. I so wish that I had been able to fulfill your hopes to lead the country in a different direction, but the nation chose another leader, and so Ann and I join with you to earnestly pray for him and for this great nation. Thank you, and God bless America. You guys are the best. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
I believe we can keep the promise of our founder. The idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are, or where you come from, or what you look like, or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try. I believe we can seize this future together because we are not as divided as our politics suggests. We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. We are, and forever will be, the United States of America. And together, with your help and God's grace, we will continue our journey forward and remind the world just why it is that we live in the greatest nation on earth. Thank you, America. God bless you. God bless these United States.
That does it for this week's edition of Capital Impact. Make sure you tune in to Capital Gains, Sundays at 11:30, right after Face the Nation, on WUSA-TV, hosted by our own Peter Cook. We'll catch you next week, Thursday at 11:30. Make sure you tune in, because we'll have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.